Today's reading is from Exodus 10, starting at verse 21 and reading through chapter 11, verse 10. And it can be found on page 50 of your pew Bibles. Then the Lord said to Moses, "Stretch out your hand toward heaven so that there may be darkness over the land of Egypt, a darkness that can be felt." So Moses stretched out his hand toward heaven, and there was dense darkness in all the land of Egypt for 3 days. People could not see one another. For 3 days they could not move from where they were. But all the Israelites had light where they lived. Then Pharaoh summoned Moses and said, "Go, worship the Lord. Only your flocks and your herds shall remain behind. Even your children may go with you." But Moses said, "You must also let us have sacrifices and burnt offerings to sacrifice to the Lord our God. Our livestock also must go with us. Not a hoof shall be left behind, for we must choose some of them for the worship of the Lord our God, and we will not know what to use to worship the Lord until we arrive there." But the Lord hardened Pharaoh's heart, and he was unwilling to let them go. Then Pharaoh said to him, "Get away from me. Take care that you do not see my face again, for on the day you see my face, you shall die." Moses said, "Just as you say, I will never see your face again." The Lord said to Moses, "I will bring one more plague upon Pharaoh and upon Egypt. Afterwards, he will let you go from here indeed. When he lets you go, he will drive you away. Tell the people that every man is to ask his neighbor and every woman is to ask her neighbor for objects of silver and gold." The Lord gave the people favor in sight of the Egyptians. Moreover, Moses himself was a man of great importance in the land of Egypt, in the sight of Pharaoh's officials, in the sight of the people. Moses said, "Thus says the Lord, about midnight I will go throughout Egypt. Every firstborn in the land of Egypt will die, from the firstborn of Pharaoh who sits on the throne to the firstborn of the female slave who is behind the handmill, and all the firstborn of the livestock. Then there will be a loud cry throughout the whole land of Egypt, such as has never been and will ever be again. But not a dog shall growl at any of the Israelites, not at people, not at animals, so that you may know that the Lord makes a distinction between Egypt and Israel. Then all these officials of yours shall come down to me and bow low to me, saying, 'Leave us, you and all the people who follow you. After that, I will leave you.'" And in hot anger, he left Pharaoh. The Lord said to Moses, "Pharaoh will not listen to you, in order that my wonders may be multiplied in the land of Egypt." Moses and Aaron performed all these wonders before Pharaoh, but the Lord hardened Pharaoh's heart, and he did not let the people of Israel go out of his land.
The Lord said to Moses, "I will bring one more plague upon Pharaoh and upon Egypt. Afterwards, he will let you go from here. Indeed, when he lets you go, he will drive you away." What a reversal is coming. Yahweh's plan is so momentous that this stubborn Pharaoh won't just let them go. He will drive them away. Well, last week we saw 8 of the plagues, and today we see the final 2. Firstly, darkness versus light. There are ancient Egyptian texts suggesting that in their view, a sign of the most skilled magician or a sign of the highest of sorcerers would be to plunge Egypt into darkness for 3 days. This is exactly what Yahweh does. We've already seen the magicians of Pharaoh try to copy the signs God does through Moses and Aaron. And at first they were able to copy the signs. And when they no longer could, The magician said, "This is the finger of a god." If there was any doubt, this plague now hooks into the Egyptians' own beliefs about the powers held by only the highest of sorcerers. Not only does Yahweh plunge Egypt into darkness, but he keeps the Israelites in the light. I love the quote by St. Francis of Assisi, "All the darkness in the world cannot put out the light of a single candle." The darkness that Yahweh brought on Egypt was so deep it could be felt. It was a really dark, dense, foreboding darkness. So Yahweh now puts Egypt in darkness and Israel into light. For 400 years, it was Egypt drawing Israel into darkness, trying to keep Israel in darkness. But Yahweh's reversal sees Egypt in darkness, Israel in light. All the darkness of Egypt could not extinguish the candle of light that God placed within the children of Abraham through his covenant promises. And so in the plague of darkness, Israel is shown to be in the light. Physically and spiritually, Israel lives in God's light and will enter the freedom that's been promised to them. God has two purposes in all that he's been doing. He explained them in chapter 6, verses 2 to 8. One of these purposes is the liberation of the descendants of Abraham as God had promised. The other is, "I will take you as my people." They are to be freed and they are to be redeemed. Through the Passover and the Exodus, they're redeemed and formed as a distinctive nation, as the people of Yahweh. They are the bearers of his covenant promises. So in this sermon series, we're tracing the birth of a nation, God's chosen nation of Israel. The reversal is coming. Pharaoh has oppressed God's people for long enough. As sign mounts upon sign and plague mounts upon plague, the tension is building and building and building. Something has to give. This tension is building towards a dramatic and cataclysmic breakout moment. There's been just a few little signs of a crumbling in Egypt's wall of stubbornness. There was a magician saying, "This is the finger of a god." When God warned of the plague of hail, some of the Egyptian officials believed and rushed out and got their household and their possessions and brought them under cover. Pharaoh's heart was still hard, but we see in this passage that the rest of the Egyptians are seeing more plainly Moses' power and authority. He was seen as a man of great importance. But these were only early signs of a crumbling in Egypt's hold over Israel. Pharaoh's wall of stubbornness still stands, but the pressure against it is starting to become untenable. Yahweh has shown the breadth of his power over the waters, over the animals, over disease, over light and dark, over the gods and powers of Egypt, and finally, Yahweh will show his power over life itself. As the final plague is unleashed, the death of the firstborn, Pharaoh's resistance will explode into dust. Not only will he let them go, he will drive them away. Not only will they take their flocks and herds, but their Egyptian neighbors will give them gold and give them silver and many precious articles to take with them. These possessions will become important when out in the wilderness, Israel builds its tabernacle, its tent of meeting, and builds the Ark of the Covenant, and makes all the items necessary for worshipping Yahweh. It was this gold and silver from Egypt that gave them the resources to make such beautiful things. So Egypt will drive them out and will give them a wealth of plunder as well. The final plague precipitates this crumbling of Pharaoh's oppression and control, a saving of Israel, the preserving of the firstborn of Israel from the final plague. These events are to be remembered forever. In chapter 12, God sets out rules for a festival called Passover, by which the Israelites are to remember these events forever. Today's passage is only the prologue to the final plague. It outlines what the sequence of events will be. And in this series, we won't explore chapter 12, the instructions, in detail, But for that, I encourage you to be part of our Passover dinner this year, where looking at chapter 12 is exactly what we will be doing. The Passover was to be celebrated every year by all of Israel for generations to come without end. Jewish people still celebrate the Passover every year to this day. Now, there were a few periods in their history where they stopped celebrating the Passover. That's partly why they ended up in exile about 500 years after King David. But God had told them that they must celebrate the Passover every year to remember this event of his salvation. But it's a pretty grisly kind of event to celebrate. For Egypt, it was horrific. Yet here again, we see God dealing with people within the terms of their own culture and worldview. There are some fascinating Egyptian funeral texts that have been found that were written about 500 years before the Exodus events that we're reading. And these Egyptian texts foretell a night of the slaying of the firstborn by he whose name is hidden. A night of the slaying of the firstborn by he whose name is hidden. Now, archaeologists have termed these Egyptian texts the pyramid texts and the coffin texts. This is one of the pyramid texts. Now, interestingly, at the time of Abraham, which was about the same time these coffin and these pyramid texts were written, at the time of Abraham, it's recorded that God said, "Know this for certain, your offspring shall be aliens in a land that's not theirs and shall be slaves there, and they shall be oppressed for 400 years. But I will bring judgment on the nation that they serve, and afterward they shall come out with great possessions." Back in Genesis 15, God knew what was to happen in Egypt. Had he even perhaps caused the Egyptians to form this belief about their future, to write it down in their texts, and write of the unnamed God who would cause these deaths? Those who don't see the Bible as God's word have suggested that the reason there's similarity between the ancient Egyptian texts and the book of Exodus is because the book of Exodus was just someone retelling an Egyptian story with an Israelite worldview. But we've seen that God repeatedly uses in the signs and in the plagues motifs that have great meaning for the Egyptians. He's displaying his power in their terms. And so they had stories of the night of the slaying of the firstborn by one whose name is hidden. And now Yahweh has declared his name, and the slaying of the firstborn is upon them. Yahweh is appropriating one of their most sacred and fearsome death texts, and now they know Israel must go. They must be rid of Israel if they're to survive. The focus on the firstborn is not just about individuals. In chapter 4, verse 22, Yahweh describes Israel itself as his firstborn son. He said, "Then you shall say to Pharaoh, 'Thus says Yahweh, Israel is my firstborn son. I said to you, let my son go that he may worship me, but you refuse to let him go. Now I will kill your firstborn son.'" Corporately, together as a nation, Israel are Yahweh's firstborn son. More than 1,000 years later, we Gentiles will be grafted into the people of God. But here is Israel, his chosen firstborn son. Now, this Pharaoh's father had slaughtered countless Israelite baby boys. And this Pharaoh himself has been oppressing Israel severely. And the Lord declares that the night is upon him when he will bring into freedom his firstborn son. The one whose name is hidden will be hidden no more. Egypt will know Yahweh. Now, this corporate view of Israel as a firstborn son is critical to understanding the way God works. God sees all of us as individuals, but he also sees his people as a singular entity. Israel is a firstborn son. The church is a body. Sometimes the people of God are described as a bride. The actions of one person affect the whole, and an affliction of one person affects the whole. God sees humanity at the same time that he sees individuals and he sees nations. God sees the church at the same time that he sees each one of us that makes up the church. And so this is critical to understanding how Adam and Eve's sin, the sin of two people, affected all of humanity. And understanding how the death of one man, Jesus, had such a magnificent positive effect for all humanity. God sees his people as a unit in a much more communal and corporate way than our Western minds have been trained to think. It's one of the reasons why having some of our worship as us and we rather than just me can be very important and powerful. Well, those of us who are not Jewish can rejoice in our invitation through Jesus to be grafted into the people of God, to be rescued from darkness, to be dwelling in light. Back in chapter 2, we noticed that Moses seemed like a very unlikely hero. But as we reach chapter 11, he's looking more and more like a hero and more like a powerful leader. He confronts Pharaoh again and again to announce and enact the plagues. And when Pharaoh tries to negotiate, Moses is unyielding in his demands. Moses is described as a man of great importance in the land of Egypt, in the sight of Pharaoh's officials and in the sight of the people. Pharaoh says, "Get away from me. Take care that you do not see my face again, for on the day you see my face, you will die." And Moses retorts, "Just as you say, I will never see your face again." And then Moses describes to Pharaoh the final plague and finishes with, "There will be a loud cry throughout the whole land of Egypt, such as has never been or will ever be again. But not a dog shall growl at the Israelites, not people, not at animals, so that you may know that Yahweh makes a distinction between Egypt and Israel. And then all of these officials of yours shall come down to me and bow low to me, saying, 'Leave us, you and all the people who follow you.' And after that, I will leave." And in hot anger, Moses storms out on Pharaoh. Moses is becoming the leader that God called him to be. From those scared and humble beginnings, he's grown into what God called him to be. Throughout the rest of the Bible, Moses is referred to in these leadership ways: a leader, a prophet, the one through whom the law was given, a true hero of the faith. Yet in the book of Hebrews we read, "Moses was faithful in all God's house as a servant. Christ, however, was faithful over God's house as a son. And we are his house. We are his house if we hold firm the confidence and pride that belongs to hope." At the Passover, as they painted the blood on their door frames, the Israelites were saved by the blood of a lamb. And this is a wonderful pointer to our ultimate Saviour. The Passover was to be celebrated forever by Israel to this very day. Even Jesus celebrated the Passover. All four Gospels record examples of Jesus celebrating the Passover. And although we are a Gentile part of the church, we too can celebrate the Passover in thankfulness that God called out a people for himself and in thankfulness for his saving acts. Jesus is our Passover lamb and one greater than Moses. There's one more aspect of the Passover that I'd like to dwell on a little more this morning. It's a key part of what was required of Israel was a public, visible, and specific action of identifying with Yahweh. They had to obey the instructions about the meal, and they had to paint the blood on their doorframes, out the front of their homes. Just like the Egyptians had a choice to bring in their household from the field before the hail hit, so each Israelite family had a choice to make, a choice to take part in what God asked and to put the sign on their doorframe. Part of being a follower of Yahweh today, of being a disciple of Jesus, is that we must be prepared to be public and visible about who we belong to. There are so many metaphors in the Bible to describe this. We've thought today about light and dark. Jesus told us to let our light shine before people so that they might see. Jesus told his disciples that as they went out into the world, they should make disciples and baptize and teach. This Hebrews passage talks about having confidence and pride in being part of God's house. Now, while many Jewish people today have sadly not understood that Jesus is the Messiah they've been waiting for, one of the human reasons for their enduring existence as a distinct people is that they do not shy away from being different. They don't seek to blend in because they know they are different from the world around them. Jewish people are proud of their identity, proud of their history, of their status as children of Abraham, kept forever in covenant with God. We can learn from that. Perhaps we can be challenged by that. This morning, do you choose the light of Yahweh and the light of Jesus, the only begotten Son? Do you publicly and visibly identify with Yahweh wherever he leads? Like Moses, will you allow God to so grow you in confidence and boldness and the gifts of his Spirit that you can stride out even before a Pharaoh and declare the truth of God? This Exodus event, with 2 more weeks left in the series, could not have happened without the total surrender of Israel to the will and direction of Yahweh. It could not have happened without their public and visible identification of each Israelite family declaring Yahweh is their God, and it's in Yahweh they put their hope and their trust. The lambs that were slaughtered that first Passover night would have been a considerable financial commitment for a community of slaves, but they held nothing back. It was all about God. And so as I invite the worship band back up here, I want to finish with these questions. What is one thing you can do this week to more publicly and visibly own your faith? What's one thing you could let go of that's holding you back from total surrender to the will of God in your life? On this night, the Israelites held nothing back. It was all about Yahweh. So what about you? And what about me? And what about us?